Good morning, everyone. I think we'll get started here. My name's Tim Wiggan, and I'm the head of equities at TD Securities. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this morning to our annual Telecom and Media Forum. We've been hosting a communications conference for well over 15 years at TD Securities, but I'm happy to say this does mark the 15-year anniversary of including telecom on the agenda under the leadership of Vince Valentini. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Vince and his team and all my partners here at TD Securities for putting on this great event. I think you're going to enjoy it. As usual, the team has assembled the brightest minds in the cable, media, and telecom space. We're going to have the opportunity to hear their thoughts on how the industry is evolving and their views for the future. But this is meant to be interactive, and so we would encourage you to participate fully. So in order to set the table and maybe get your creative juices flowing, I thought it would make sense to look back over the past 15 years and highlight some of the changes that have occurred since Vince has founded this conference. First of all, 15 years ago, Facebook, Netflix, and the iPhone didn't exist. So I'm guessing you would have seen a lot more of your teenage kids at that time than you do today, if you have them. In 2002, there were 11 million cell phone subscribers in Canada. Today, there's well over 30 million. And the fastest internet speed was 4 megabytes per second versus 44 today, and some homes connecting at 1 gigabit per second. So clearly, there's been a tremendous amount of change over that period, and that pace of change is not slowing down. The industry is working on 5G wireless services, and it's expected in the year 2020 there will be over 200 million devices connected to the internet here in Canada. So clearly, it's an exciting time. We're excited to have a great agenda for you here today, and I wanted to thank you again for attending. So with that, I'll turn it over to Vince to introduce our first panel. Vince?
Thanks very much, Tim, and my thanks to everybody for being here as well today. And special thanks to our first speaker from BC, Glen LeBlanc, who I'm sure everybody knows well, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. So Glen, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
Okay. Let me kick it off with just a general question. I mean, your thoughts on the current state of the market environment, both the economy and the competitive landscape, and then maybe also a brief update on how things are going in Manitoba and the integration of MTS.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the second part of the question first, Vince. Things with MTS are proceeding very, very well. As you know, kind of a core competency at BCE is integration. We've done a lot of it over the last 7 or 8 years, and the team is really tremendous at doing it and organizing a plan, and MTS has been no different. I'm very pleased at where we're at, and you've seen it with an announcement we made a number of months ago where we changed our target from 50 million to 100 million on synergies after we get in there and seen opportunities that we had, a lot of it to deal with traffic, network backhaul. We looked at 50% of our enterprise customers have offices operating in Manitoba, and to be able to take that traffic off net, and now it's on our net network, we've seen opportunities there. So very pleased with how the synergies are going, how the integration is going. So couldn't be better on MTS, and pleased there. As far as the overall general state of the economy or general state of the competitive landscape, one thing for being in this industry for nearly 25 years is that I would say that the competitive landscape really moves and ebbs and flows, but it truly never changes. It's competitive, whether that shifts from a region, a community, a competitor, or through timing throughout the year as the end of a quarter, or times like Black Friday and Boxing Day tend to be the most competitive days of the year. We've seen a lot of competitive activity. During last quarter, we've seen a lot of our largest competitor in this territory offering 24-month specials, $99 for 24 months on home connectivity. Yet in this quarter, early Q2, we've seen a lot of that come out of market and move to more of a 12-month, $99 promotion. So I think that's showing some rationalization and reasonableness in the offers that come in. So that's encouraging. We understand what what the strategy is. It's trying to be preemptive where we've announced fiber, where we're building fiber, where we're taking our fiber to the home product, is to try to wrap up and tie up customers into a contract for a duration of time, 12 to 24 months. So it's been very competitive. That continues, and I think coming to the end of a quarter on the wireless side, you tend to see a lot of handset subsidy competition in our country. We tend to stay away, the incumbents, from discounting of rate plans, but you see it on upfront subsidy, whether it be $199 or $99 or often even zero-price phones, come in and out of the market. We tend to, that's the shape of the competitive landscape and how we see the wireless business flow. Economically, you know, modest signs of improvement, so that's encouraging. We're seeing that particularly, you know, in Ontario and sometimes in Quebec. That said, I think it's early days, and I think we're a ways away from being able to rely on kind of a sustained 3% GDP, which in our minds is what is required to see a turnaround in our enterprise space. Until you see that sustained 3% with our large enterprise customers, we still don't see right now a lot of growth there. There's not a lot of job growth, and if there's not a lot of job growth, in all likelihood, we see communication rationalization on the communication spend.
Excellent. Thanks for that overview to start. As some of you may know, Glenn has had the pleasure, I'm sure he's been thrilled, to do a lot of conferences recently. So I'm going to, instead of asking just all the same questions, I'm going to try to drill down a little bit and understand some of the comments you made in the past few weeks a little bit better. So one is sort of CapEx versus acquisition question. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you signaled at a conference recently that your CapEx intensity going forward would be somewhere 17 to 18%, which in the past few years it's been pretty consistent at 17. So is this a sort of veiled way of saying that now that the acquisitions, or most of them, are behind you and you're going to spend 2 years integrating MTS, you don't have to spend money on acquisitions, maybe there's a little bit more money to spend on CapEx?
Yeah, I wouldn't read too much into it, Vince. 17 to 18%, you know, trying to provide a CapEx range to give us a little bit of flexibility. But let's look at what we spent in 16. It was 17.4%, so we're not migrating too far away from where we've been historically. With our capital program and in the country we live, we have to take advantage of the construction period. If we are lucky enough to advance and move fiber a little bit faster, I just wanted to ensure when I provide a range that, look, if we can advance a bit of capital, complete another community a little bit faster, opportunity presents itself, that you give yourself the flexibility to do that. But there's nothing to read into that. 17 to 18% capital intensity is essentially where we've been, right at the midpoint of that last year. That's where we see ourselves go forward. Your point on the use of cash flow is a valid one. We've seen a number of M&A opportunities in the last number of years, but realistically, I would think the pace or the frequency of M&A go forward is going to change. The opportunities just aren't there. So then that begs the question of what do you use your free cash flow for? We've historically been using a lot of free cash flow on M&A. We've unfortunately had to put a large sum of cash into the pension plan and voluntary contributions into that for a number of consecutive years. I would hope that signals of higher interest rates in the state of our pension, maybe that's behind us. So, you know, I think with spending almost $1 billion of free cash, you know, look to repay some debt right now, get that leverage back inside of the targeted range that we have over the next number of years. Eventually, we're going to have another spectrum auction. Signals are that might be as late as 20, maybe as early as 19, but that's where we'll use some excess free cash flow. But all in all, from a CapEx perspective, I think 17 to 18 remains a good target go forward.
Okay, excellent. Just on the acquisitions, before we wrap that, your position has been clear that Canada is your domain. You don't want to be expanding into the U.S. where there could be much larger acquisitions. So if we just focus on Canada, it seems like everything big and accretive you guys have already done, and you've, as you said before, it's a core competency. You've done it very well. But I see one other deal, and I want to get your thoughts on it, is the satellite business. Both yourselves and the other satellite provider have been bleeding subscribers for a couple of years now. Certainly seems like a mature market, in part because you guys, with your fiber, or stealing shit back from satellite, but it's a mature business. Does it really make sense to have two operators? Is there not natural consolidation there at some point, and would DC not be the more likely buyer if there is a deal there?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll announce that deal right here, Vince. No, in all seriousness, you have to look a little bit different in both of our landscapes. You brought it up that in our landscape, a lot of what you're seeing occur is migrating from our satellite offer to cannibalizing it with our fiber to the home, with our IPTV offering now. We have about 1.4 million subscribers, and we're seeing a steady decline in migration. Ultimately, what's going to happen with our satellite business is our satellite business is going to become a rural and non-urban offering. I don't know when that plateaus, Vince. I don't know when you see a complete plateauing of the decline that we've experienced, but let's say for argument's sake that's roughly a million subscribers, and I think that's going to take us a number of years before we see ourselves get there. I think the other satellite provider certainly is not seeing the same cannibalization from their TV offering as of yet. You know, I hear your point that one day is there efficiencies to bring those assets together. Look, the asset for us is still, you know, a very valuable asset, spins a tremendous amount of cash. 7 or 8 years' time, there's going to be a satellite requirement to be put up in the sky, and that's the time when I think your point's a valid one, is there efficiencies to be gained there by becoming up with some sharing agreement or some agreement to not have to put up two satellites. And I think that with a reduced number of subscribers, that would probably be a discussion we'd look forward to having, but that's a number of years out, Vince, so nothing to report now. I think we're managing that decline to the best of our ability and recognize that asset still is going to provide is going to be a valuable asset for us long-term in the non-urban centers.
Okay. No, that's good color. Thank you. And I'm definitely going to come back to fiber to the home because it's critical, but while we're on sort of M&A, just the other side of that coin on divestitures, is there anything new on that front with, you know, potentially non-core media assets or wireless towers or that you could spin off? And then also, when do we get to the point, maybe in some of the regions in Atlantic Canada where you came from originally, where there's enough fiber where we can take the copper out and start selling some of that CO real estate? Are there any non-core assets over the next year or two that you think could be monetized?
Look, on the first end of the front end of your question, the first part of it, I really don't see any material divestitures that we're pursuing right now. We're comfortable with the suite of assets we have. We're comfortable with what we have in our media business. We're not actively pursuing any material divestitures. We believe there's strategic value in retaining and owning our towers, as we've said for years, and that nothing has changed on that front. Great question you ask about copper. The multi-million dollar question we often get is, when do you get to a point that you can actually shut down historic copper networks? Because as we all know, under the current infrastructure and the way we're organized, for all intents and purposes, you're operating two networks. And Atlantic Canada is a great example where fiber is 7 or 8 years old. Can you see line of sight to shutting down your old copper plant and migrating all your customers onto your fiber infrastructure? I think we're still a number of years away from that, Vince. And from my perspective, the way you have to look at it is until you reach a point of probably 75 or 80% penetration on your fiber, and that's our customers on our fiber network. I don't know that you want to take the risk of forced migrating until that copper or the percentage of customers on your legacy network is in that 20 to 25% range. These, for all intents and purposes, are sleepy customers. If they haven't moved over for now, they're customers who aren't actively looking to change services, to upgrade services, to buy additional services, or are they looking to change service providers? The second you knock on their door and you tell them that a forced migration is required, then I think you wake them up, at which time they begin shopping. One of the greatest opportunities to moving a customer on fiber is to expand the suite of products they have. If these are just a voice customer and they have nothing but voice with you in it, then the cost of connecting their home to fiber, the risk of losing them to a competitor, all to get what is a one-product household, or maybe if you're lucky, a two-product household, the economics are difficult. I think there is a point, and you're right to ask the question, Vince, there's a tipping point when you say that the costs of shutting down the network exceed the lost revenue or the potential risk of revenue erosion. And I think it's still at a point that's quite high. I think it's 75 to 80%. We're not there yet in any of our markets. We watch Verizon closely. We are seeing a bit of that in small markets where they're testing it. So number of years out, particularly in the big centers like Toronto where we're in our infancy of fiber rollout.
And you've mentioned the 75 to 80% figure before. Are there any of your markets that where you're early on with fiber in Atlantic Canada where you may be getting into the 60s at least?
Or like we are, definitely. We're seeing areas where, I'll speak from a market share perspective, where we've taken north of 50% market share from our cable competitors in internet and video. So, yeah, I mean, there's signs in small regions that we can start entertaining testing in the coming years of what type of customer experience you'd have in a forced migration. But we're a few years out yet, Ben.
Excellent. So let's stay on fiber. Other than the market share benefits and the obvious improvement in product quality, what about ARPU and churn and other operating costs you can take out? Do you want to update us on the benefits of fiber?
Yeah, as you say, it's not just the improved product quality, which allows us to offer the best internet in the market. We think the best TV offering in the market. What excites me beyond that is the cost efficiencies, the operating efficiencies. You know, it's not fair to compare a fiber network to a fiber to the home network to a copper network. So let me compare it to our fiber to the node network. We see, 40%+ reduction in truck rolls in our fiber to the home footprint over our fiber to the node footprint, and that is substantial. We see 50% fewer, cheaper reduction in preventive maintenance and maintenance costs that are required in a fiber to the home network. Naturally, we see significant churn benefits in a fiber to the home network. So, on average, we're saving about $3 of operating costs per month per subscriber that's operating on a fiber to the home network versus node or copper. And as you look out into the future, you think of the telco of tomorrow, and we can debate the time horizon, Vince, but let's pick a time in the future and call it 2025. And with the vast majority of our fiber footprint completed with fiber, you're going to see significantly less truck rolls, get to a point where we have the physical drop to the home in place and the ONT connected in your home. You move out of your home, I move in, there's no truck roll required, all of the facilities are there. In all likelihood, we have no wiring required in the home. We use today wireless set-top boxes. It's not hard to envision. And then 2025, there'll be no electronics in the home whatsoever, as it'll be delivered over the top. The customer of today, and particularly the customer of the future, doesn't want to call contact centers. They want to serve online. We're improving online tools. You get to a step change in the cost of operating the telco, in a decade time from the telco of today. So the fiber to the node network, as exciting it is on the suite of products that we're offering, I'm equally as excited on what it's going to do for a shift change in cost structure of our company.
And that certainly sounds very credible and exciting. And given that, I mean, you get this question all the time, but are you going fast enough? You've articulated a plan of 600,000 or 700,000 new fiber to the home builds per year, and that's going to take you 8 to 10 years to finish it. As you know, your peer in Western Canada is on track to be finished in more like 4 or 5 years. Can you not go faster?
Well, let's talk about the number of homes we're completing in absolute terms versus, our competitor in the West has a much smaller physical footprint to complete. Now, we now cover 73% of the Canadian landscape with our wireline services. That's a big footprint. That's 11 million homes. That is complex in communities. Toronto's a great example of that. 60% of Toronto is aerial, meaning 40% is buried. A lot of the community we get to is has conduit, but we find out the conduit's old. It's crushed, requiring us to bore and put a new conduit in. telephone poles we wish to connect to are 40 years old, and we make a decision when we're there that it's probably best to replace that infrastructure. We need right-of-ways. We need to work with hydro companies for attachment agreements to their poles. It is not as simple as throwing money at it and saying, can you go faster? Look, every year we're trying to find efficiencies. We were doing 500,000. Then you heard me talking about 600,000, and now you've heard us alluding to 700,000. I think we're trying to eke out modest improvements of the speed while not losing the state of efficiency. You can't just hire and expand your workforce, lay your workforce off as the weather changes in our country, hire your workforce again during construction periods. The efficiencies are lost when you do that. Very expensive to do that. You don't want to hire contractors, again, utilize them, train them, then lay them off only to find out they're gone to work for somebody else during that off season. So we're in the sweet spot of moving as fast as we can with all of those engineering challenges, the construction challenges, the weather challenges, inside a responsible spending envelope. I don't think we'll ever stop pushing, Vince, to see if 700,000 can ultimately become 800,000 and beyond. You know, we're going to hit 3.6 million homes with fiber, ultimately maybe 8 to 9 million, so we got 5 to go. If you can knock off 700,000 a year, it's in 5 to 7 years' time, we're going to be in a formidable place. You start to see the evolution of 5G technology. How can that play a role? And I think that all fits. So it's a great question. I think we're moving as fast as we think we can efficiently move, and that won't stop.
The water's not strategic.
Yeah, no, I think.
Oh, do you have one?
I have one here.
Thanks. You didn't want to have to have you reach across me to grab one if you need it. So just a specific data point then on Toronto. As I'm sure everybody knows, your plan has been to complete Toronto by next year and then move on to the next major build in Montreal. Have you softly signaled that even though most of Toronto will still be done by the end of this year, so I think it's up to 700,000 out of the 1.1 million total
homes.
That's right. But you were supposed to be done the remaining balance by the middle of 2018, and now you may have been thinking that could be pushed out to the end of 2018. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it's just, again, I don't want you to read much into it, Vince. We believe that we'll be materially done in 18. Is that June or is that September or the second half of 18? It's really so many variables, weather permitting. If we have a rough January, February, as we had in some of our regions in Canada this year, if we have that in Toronto, you know, that can delay the pace of which we can roll out. We are excited that we are going to have 416 completed in 2018, and the timing works so tremendous for us, as our largest competitor is going to launch their new TV platform about the same time when we're completing our fiber. So whether that's March or June or September, the importance is that fiber to the home network is going to be complete at a time when our largest competitor is launching a new TV platform. And to date, our advertising has been one of putting TV as the star of the show. Obviously, our competitor had speed advantages in fiber, in internet. And now that we have fiber, I think we can start moving to video not necessarily being the only star of the show, but internet being a star of the show. So I think that completing in 18 is important to us. I'm not overly worried about which quarter that is. I'm just excited that it kind of fits nicely on top of their launch of X1.
So a big enough critical mass that you can start a little more mass advertising.
Good point.
And a little more creative.
Yeah, well, we're going to be beyond the critical mass this calendar. So we can start mass marketing in early 18.
Okay. So the nasty flip side of spending all this money on these networks, granted, the performance and benefits to you is huge, but unfortunately our regulator forces you to allow others to use that network, which is diametrically opposed to what the U.S. Rules are, and they're going even further in the other direction of not allowing these to be considered, you know, utilities that just anybody can grab a hold of. What are your guys' thoughts of, you know, what the CRTC has done on with these regulated or interim rates? And is there some hope that, you know, once the CRTC sets final rates, we can then just jump over them and go to the actual government, who may have a bit more sanguine head about it and say, look, if these rules are in place, why are we going to keep investing in our networks? If you want good networks in Canada, you got to let us build them and then use them and not let others just piggyback for free. What are your thoughts about government versus CRTC and what your chances are?
Well, I think you summarized it quite well, Vince. Historically, it's no news to anyone that we've been disappointed with some of the historic decisions that have given people open access to our networks, that has failed to recognize the cost and the investments of that we've put into those networks. Look, we're at a time of change right now where we're going to see a new chair for the CRTC put in place, I would think relatively soon. It's too early for us to comment on what that chair, what attitude they'll bring, what change in direction they'll bring. What I can assure you is we have open lines of communication with government now. You know, we have a healthy dialogue with government, a two-way dialogue, a government that's interesting in listening to us. That doesn't mean all the decisions they make will go our way. I was very comforted by Minister Bain's comments around facility-based competition and their commitment to that structure. So the bottom line is, I think, let's see who is put in place. I can assure you that we're going to continue to educate and inform them of our concerns. There's a reason why Canada has some of the best networks in the world, both in a wireless infrastructure and a wired infrastructure. Let's not lose sight of how we got here, which is large organizations like BCE making the necessary investments. And if we can't earn an adequate return on that investment, you know, we're not going to make it. So that education, or continued education with government, with regulators, I'm excited that we've got some change in front of us, and let's hope that we have someone who wants to sit down and really work with us. And that's our focus.
Good. I'm going to open up the audience in a few minutes to get your questions ready if you have any, but let's switch gears to wireless for a minute first. First off, obviously, a little bit of news yesterday from one of your new entrants to competitors. What are your updated thoughts on the potential threat from Shaw finishing LTE, maybe getting the iPhone, and now they have low-band spectrum? Do you think that this could be a bit more of a competitive market a year from now than what we see today?
Well, I don't think what occurred yesterday was a surprise to anyone. I think we all knew that when Shaw made a decision to get into the wireless business, that they were going to require additional spectrum to be competitive, and they've acquired spectrum that many suspected would occur. So there's no news to us. We've seen this coming. We knew they'd get the spectrum. Shaw are heavily investing now and rolling out an LTE network. And as you know, Vince, we're just about to complete our LTE Advanced network. We're the first ones doing tri-band carrier aggregation, quad-band carrier aggregation. We have a speed advantage in every market we operate. Despite the acquired spectrum, I think Shaw will still find themselves at a fairly sizable speed disadvantage. I'm sure, as they said yesterday, it's not just the cost of the acquiring of spectrum, now it's the cost of network deployment, which will be, I can assure you, sizable. We know it all too well. So this is a business that, you know, requires investment, constant investment, to be leading edge. The LTE network currently that they're deploying is on AWS-3, which many of the handsets you alluded to, like the iPhone, don't operate currently on that. So, sure, Shaw will get more competitive as each year passes and the investments they make. We are very comfortable at our spectrum position, our network sharing agreements with TELUS. What we're rolling out, what our engineers are doing is just incredible on carrier aggregation and what they've been able to do. So being the network leader in wireless is our focus, and I can assure you that's not going to change.
Excellent. So you predicted what they've done so far. So maybe you can help us predict another potential move over the next couple of years. Do you think Shaw will be able to get a network sharing deal with Rogers the same way that Quebecor was? And does that concern you?
I'll leave that question for you to ask to Shaw. I'm not going to speculate on their conversations with Roger.
Not if they can do it, but if they did get it done, do you think that's a game changer from Bell's competitive perspective, or is this part of the envelope and you can deal with it as well?
I think it's part of the competitive landscape. If it happens, I can assure you we'll be there to compete. Regardless of what sharing agreements they sign, I think it would have implications on our other competitors more so than us, and we'll wait and see if that goes there, but that's a speculation that is beyond my knowledge.
Sounds good. Enough about the future. Let's just talk about what's happened recently. Obviously, there's been a tremendous wireless market for you guys and for your two national competitors. Subscriber volume has been very strong, and you've talked a lot about that. So let me jump to the next level. You've seen these good EBITDA gains, even with the higher gross loading by all the carriers, in part because the upgrade and retention cycles seem to have slowed down. Like people are just keeping their phones, I guess, longer, mm-hmm. or maybe you carriers are all managing it better. Can you talk about that dynamic? Is that sustainable, or are people just saying, hey, the changes in form function of my new iPhone or Samsung are not that big, so I'm just going to keep it longer, and that benefits your margins and retention costs?
I think you're spot on. Naturally, Vince, it moves in cycles. If the device is coming out, and we all know with the state of the Canadian dollar in the last year, we've seen landed device costs go up. Customers are walking into stores and seeing a fairly significant upfront price point to pick up a new device, and that device better have product attribute or attributes that are they're materially better, I guess, than their current phone. In the event that that isn't the case, and I would say it's fair to say that the last number of devices launched, many people felt didn't have material attributes warranting the high price points. What that results in is people are hanging onto their devices longer and longer, so a 24-month upgrade cycle might stretch past 30 months. And you're right, that benefits all of the carriers there. It'll be interesting to see what's going to occur this fall. I know Apple is launching their new device. What will that device look like? What will it have those attributes that really drive the early adopters to want to move now? All that said, the early indication is that's going to be a price point of around $1,200 Canadian. So that's quite a barrier. There'll be subsidies. Naturally, all of us will offer subsidies. And Black Friday is always an interesting time, as is Boxing Day. But I think the cycles are going a little longer, and that certainly has helped with the EBITDA performance that you're seeing at BCE. The run we've had, Vince, has been tremendous. Very, very pleased. 7.5% EBITDA growth in Q1, and 4.2% EBITDA growth ARPU growth was exceptional. And probably a little ahead of what I expected.
Ahead of my expectations as well. Subscriber growth, ARPU growth, EBITDA growth, all fantastic. The one area where Bell has not delivered as well as TELUS or Rogers is on churn reduction. They've both been lowering their churn, and TELUS obviously is demonstrably lower than the other two. You guys have kind of stayed the same or even crept up in some quarters. Is that deliberate, or is that a concern for management that you really want to focus on, or is it just a trade-off between ARPU and churn that you're quite happy with?
Well, there's a part of it that is deliberate. You've heard me say many, many times, Vince, that our number one focus in wireless is that we get our fair share of the net adds and a disproportionate share of the industry EBITDA, and we have done that quarter after quarter after quarter. So that is our primary focus, meaning that at times we won't chase customers, we won't spend aggressively on churn if it jeopardizes that ultimate objective. That said, I mean, we're all trying to reduce churn and create a customer experience that reduces churn for our customers. However, you have to remember that a big part of our territory is Quebec, where we have a formidable competitor in Videotron. And if we look out westward, we haven't had that new entrant in market out west. Until recent. So I think when we look at churn rates for our Western competitor, I think you have to put that in perspective. There hasn't been a new entrant in their territory as we've experienced in ours, and that plays a true factor in it. Churn will always be a focus. There's not a meeting that goes by we don't speak about it and attempt to improve it, but I I haven't shifted our priorities with being EBITDA first and getting a disproportionate share of that. It will be priority number one.
Great. One more wireless question for me, then I'm going to see if the audience has any stimulating questions for you. The 5G, a lot of people talk about it a lot more, especially with developments in the U.S. With fiber builds and new spectrum purchases. What are your thoughts? Both, is this sort of a quantum step up in costs and new spectrum that might be required over the next 5 or 10 years? And what kind of incremental revenue opportunities do you guys see at this point?
Well, it's early, Vince. 5G, a lot of talk about 5G, but I think it's premature. I think first commercial applications are probably Tokyo 2020. I don't think we see it here in Canada until 2022. In my mind, 5G is really nothing more than network evolution from 3G, 4G, LTE, LTE Advanced, and now 5G. What I do know is that 5G is going to require a deep fiber investment. It's going to require fiber deeper and deeper into your network, because that's all really 5G is, isn't it? It's about small cell deployment with a fiber backhaul. So what we're doing on our infrastructure investment today on the wireline side is going to pay great benefits for our 5G deployment when we get there. Early for me to say what revenue opportunities are, but what I do know is when we build faster networks, people consume more data. It is that simple. 37% increase in data consumption in Q1 of this past year. It is phenomenal that as we roll out LTE Advanced and you can download a movie in 1 minute versus 2 minutes, people download two movies in 2 minutes. So it's incredible, but that's what is occurring. 5G is just going to improve that network speed, obviously network coverage, and I think it's going to continue on that, giving us that runway for revenue growth via data consumption.
Excellent. You mentioned the need for the fiber infrastructure. Obviously, you have a very constructive network sharing deal with TELUS, so you don't have to build fiber across all of Alberta and BC. That's their territory. I assume you'll just share that, but is there a problem if they're ahead of you in 4 or 5 years of when 5G starts getting rolled out and their fiber to the home is all done and yours isn't? Do you figure out a way just to pay them a little bit of extra money, or do you just not get access to their network until you're done? Or how does
I won't get into the intricacies of the network sharing agreement, but suffice to say that we monitor pace and speed with one another and keep each other honest that there's nobody disadvantaged on the speed we're moving. So each and every community is discussed, and we ensure that we have access to the technology we need to roll out 5G via their network and vice versa.
Okay. So you've got that figured out. We don't have to worry.
You don't have to worry, man.
It's done. Any questions in the audience? There's a couple of microphones. If you do have a question, raise your hand. We'll get it to you so the people on the webcast can hear it. Looks like we're not serving strong enough coffee, Glenn.
We have one in the middle here.
Oh, sorry. Do you mind, sir, just wait to grab that mic?
Hi. That's better. On the fiber to the home, you mentioned $3 savings in operating costs. That's your sort of prediction. Is there any scale to that savings as you roll out further?
Is there a scale to that? Is that the question?
To the savings. Your savings in operating costs, you said it was $3.
Oh, yeah. I think we're in our infancy. As I said, each community we complete, as fiber gets deeper into our network, I fast forward to a time when right now all of those savings are about preventive maintenance. They're about reduced truck rolls, reduced calls to our contact center. But each year that passes, the big opportunity I see for scale is what I'll refer to as left-in-place network. And I mentioned it in my earlier remarks. We go out today and we bring fiber, for most cases, most neighborhoods, we bring it past your home. But we don't bring it into your home until you make a service order. There are exceptions to that in buried communities where we're going to go in once and we're going to complete the build. But when you make a call to us and you request service, we bring the fiber drop from the pole into your home and we put the electronics required to run the service in your home. Obviously, as we fast forward down the road, each home that we've already done is going to be left in place, I refer to it as. So you can see the scale advantages far enough down the road when all of those homes are connected that a call will not mean a truck roll. It'll literally be a flip of the switch for us to deliver services to you with no truck roll, all self-install. I mean, I'm a number of years old, but your point is a very valid one, that this is truly scalable. Early savings are all about field maintenance. Future savings are going to be about field and home connection and in-home wiring, and it's going to be about truck rolls and contact center calls. So I think absolutely scalable.
Good question. Thank you. Anybody else? We've got a couple minutes left. Let me switch gears to a topic I don't hear you talk about very often, although you've invested a lot in it, is data centers. Bell has built some of your own. You obviously acquired Q9. We don't hear a lot about that space. We hear about it from some of your cable peers who have it as sort of distinct entities. But how are you guys doing there? Is that a source of good revenue growth, and does it help you sell connectivity?
It is, Vince. It's gone very, very well. As you know, we took out took in Q9 and the percentage of Q9 we didn't own last year, and that's gone very well. And one of the big reasons for that is your comment you just made is the pull-through of connectivity. On data centers that we've owned, we had about a 70% connectivity pull-through. On data centers that we didn't own, albeit we had an equity holding position in Q9, we only had about a 25% connectivity pull-through. One of the big opportunities we've seen in acquiring Q9 is to bring that connectivity pull-through in line with what we experience with our own data centers, and early days are indicating that we're moving that direction. Q9 acquisition is going exceptionally well. I still think we have excess capacity in data centers in our country. So managing what can sometimes be a rational pricing in the marketplace, we have to be careful. That's a little bit of what we're still experiencing. But all in all, business is performing well. We think we have a great set of data centers across our country in all different geographies, and that's going to bode well for the future and most importantly, for connectivity pull-through.
Have you ever talked about how much dry powder you have in your existing capacity, like what your utilization rate is?
We haven't ever disclosed that, Vince. No. We don't have that off the top of my head.
No. And maybe last question, the always exciting topic of pensions. So Bank of Canada has talked about raising rates potentially soon. You may be one of the few people cheering about that, unless you have a big mortgage. Can you just update us on where the solvency deficit stands, and how much rates have to go up to take you from not only no funding, but when you're in a surplus position, you get cash holiday?
Sure. I think, Vince, you and I have been talking about this for about 12 years, I think, maybe longer. And I kept predicting rates would go up, so I'm going to stop predicting because I've been wrong for about 7 or 8 consecutive years. We're in very good shape now with the pension plan. You know that many years I spoke about trying to keep north of a 90% solvency funding ratio. Happy to report we're at 95% now. So I think we are on what I hope to be the other side of large voluntary contributions that we've had to make. I'm not suggesting that you don't have $100 or $200 million here or there that you entertain if it makes good sense. But as you know, Vince, in the last 8 or 10 years, we've put billions into the pension plan as required to keep that solvency where it's at. I think we now are past that point of it being a true burden to us, as it has historically. Your point about sensitivity, even with 70% fixed income, 30% equity, you get about $300 million net benefit from a 25 basis point increase in interest rates. So 75 to 100 basis point movement in interest rates would actually put us at 105, 106% surplus position. And when we reach that point, and this is why you say I'm one of the few people who cheer for rising interest rates, is that we can take north of $200 million contribution, annual contribution holiday. So it is actually cash flow beneficial for us to see interest rates rise. Now, few have that pension opportunity we have in the event that we get to a point of of surplus that we can move into contribution holiday. So let's hope the signals early this week about interest rate movement is finally real.
And the 95% funded, that includes MTS?
It does.
Okay.
It does.
Well, we'll leave it there, Glenn. Thank you very much for your comments this morning. It was very, very insightful. Thanks for joining us.
Great as always. Okay. Thank you, Vince.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.